This is the Pastor Podcast with Randy and Andy. Andy Payton is the lead pastor at Methodist Temple United Methodist Church in Evansville, Indiana. Randy Moore is associate pastor at Methodist Temple. Their goal is to see Christ in everything and everyone.
Welcome in to the Pastor's Podcast with Randy and Andy. I'm Randy Moore, the Associate Pastor at Methodist Temple in Evansville, Indiana. As always, I'm joined by the Senior Pastor, the Lead Pastor here at Methodist Temple, Andy Payton. Andy, good to sit down with you again.
It's good to be here, Randy. It's good to be with you.
Yeah. Well, as we said last week, we both were required to paint pictures because what we had to talk about was very visual, and you're going to be talking about stained glass windows, and so we're going to do some of that painting with words again today. And my situation was I've broken my ankle, and I explained how that happened last week, and I keep being told you need a better story. So maybe today, if not on the podcast, maybe after, we'll come up with a better story that maybe over time, when we look back on it, it'll be heroic.
Yes.
Right? Okay. But I bring that up to say that I missed my accident. Happened on Good Friday. I was not in church on Easter Sunday, and I was not in church the first Sunday after Easter. Sunday, this past Sunday, was my first time back, and I came not as pastor, but I came to worship. And I said this to a lot of people. I said, for the first time since I've been here, it'll be 2 years real soon, this is the first time I've worshiped. Mm-hmm. And everybody knows what I mean.
Right.
When you have responsibilities, be it preaching or serving as liturgist or just being the pastor to the people, it's not that it's not meaningful. It's not that it's not important. It's not that there aren't rewards, stuff that there aren't things, but it's not the same as worshiping. And I was able to worship, and worship was really, really good.
You know, good.
On Sunday, it was really, really good. It was good to be there.
Yeah, that's something that happens to pastors or anybody else that, you know, is part of the worship service. The tendency is if you're part of the worship service in the sense that you're doing something on the stage, if you will, you're always thinking about the next thing. I'm going to go do this. I got to be that, do that. I'm going to say this. I'm going to say that. And it's work, right? That's what it is.
It is.
And I mean, there's moments, like you said, that we experience God's presence and there's a sense of the holy, but it's much different being able to come in, meditate, experience, sing, just be a part of it as opposed to what we typically do.
Yeah. You're right. We're always thinking about the next thing. And I know you do something that I haven't done yet, but I'm sure I will incorporate it into my practice sooner or later, is that you text the various people on the worship team. If you have something to say, you're sitting back, you're sitting there where we sit, and you're texting up to the sound booth.
Yeah, we edit the service sometimes in real time.
Right.
Example would be at 11 o'clock, in our 11 o'clock service this past week, in the first service, in 8:30, we had a baptism, and we had a picture of the little baby boy, Frank Arnold, that was baptized. Beautiful, wonderful experience in the first service, but then I wanted to share that with the second service. So I was texting Maggie Selby up in the booth saying, hey, can we put that picture of Frank up there? It, you know, that was happening all in real time during the worship service, but technology is great in some ways.
It is. It's double-edged like a lot of things, and certainly technology is double-edged, but the sharp edge, the positive edge, is so good if you use it well.
Sure.
So good. Okay, it was good to be back on Sunday, and we'll take it a week at a time here, but the podcast is something that I can do. All it requires is that I sit down and talk. So I can do that. Andy, you're into a new series, and this is on the stained glass windows here at the Methodist Temple. Both sides of the sanctuary are lined with stained glass windows. Just give us the brief history on that and what's represented there.
Okay, well, one of the things that's wonderful about our sanctuary is we do have a series of quite stunning stained glass windows. On one side of the sanctuary are the Beatitudes. On the other side of the sanctuary are a series of Jesus's parables that are depicted. Also, events in Jesus's life. If you look closely, there's some smaller windows where the events of Jesus's life are depicted, like his Holy Family at one point. And so the series could go on for quite a while. But in many ways, what it does is it tells the story of what it means to be a disciple of Jesus through art And so we're going through all these windows as a way to talk about what they have to teach us to be, you know, in terms of being a disciple of Jesus. But also, I think it helps people experience the space differently once we've reflected upon, hey, look at that window, look at that story in that window. And hopefully it helps the folks at Methodist Temple to experience our sanctuary as even more of a sacred space.
And you can catch a message at a glance, but you can, if you've got time to spend with it, there's a lot of interpretive stuff that can be going on as well.
Yeah. I mean, every one of them. And I'm noticing things in them. I'm on my third window, so I'm working on my third sermon in the series. But every time I've said, oh my goodness, I never noticed that, never saw that before. And so it's really neat. I'm excited about it. It's going to be fun. I'm excited for you to come and join me and do a couple of sermons.
Yes, there you go. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I'll come on maybe after a podcast one day, I'll go in there by myself and
contemplate.
And take a look. Okay, so your first sermon was really kind of an introduction to the series, and you used the one standalone window, and that's the one that's above the organ, and it's called the Rose Window.
Yes. Largest window in the sanctuary, the Rose Window. It is a depiction of the risen Christ ascending to heaven and sending forth the Holy Spirit. And so those are three huge theological themes within Christianity. Of course, we are a community that centralizes itself as Christians. We're a community that finds our common denominator in the risen Christ. And then we believe the risen Christ has ascended to heaven. What do we mean by that? Well, Jesus, the risen Christ, is one with God. What's true about Jesus is true about God. And then we also believe in the Holy Spirit, too, that God is with us today. And so that window really is the foundation of our faith, that we believe that there's a Christ-like God with us, that is the central aspect of our faith that holds us together as a community. And so I started there with the largest window with the biggest message. And then last week we talked about the blessed are the poor in spirit, the first of the Beatitudes, and then we're going to be working through the Beatitudes in the weeks ahead.
Yeah, so of course this is based on the Sermon on the Mount from the Gospel of Matthew. And so for last Sunday, you mentioned it that the Beatitude was the directed at the poor in spirit. And it reads like this, just starting with the beginning here in verse 1. When Jesus saw the crowds, he went up the mountain, and after he sat down, his disciples came to him, and he began to speak and taught them, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." And before we get into your sermon, let's spend just a little bit on the text itself, because there's so much there. These seem so upside down, the Beatitudes as a whole, but it's blessed are the poor in spirit. I think the first thing is defining what blessed means, because it's been translated in other ways. After that, blessed are the poor in spirit. We are so heavenly minded that we automatically read this, blessed will be the poor in spirit. Mm-hmm. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Mm-hmm. Now, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And of course, Jesus came to bring this kingdom of heaven.
Right.
To begin unfolding even in his time.
Right.
So there's a lot there.
Oh my. Well, this is the Sermon on the Mount. The Beatitudes are, if you want to know what it means to be a follower of Jesus and what the dispositions of a believer's heart are supposed to be according to Jesus, that just look at the Beatitudes. I mean, that's why we put them on the stained glass windows. John Wesley actually dedicated a whole book in his standard sermons to preaching through the Beatitudes as well, the Sermon on the Mount. And so you asked a question about blessed. What does it mean to be blessed? And there's a lot of different interpretations of that word. But the Greek word that's used here really just means you're in a fortunate place, mm-hmm. which is, you know, that's a challenge when you think about you're in a fortunate place if you're poor in spirit. What's that all about? And so what this is really pointing to, though, is how the gospel, according to Jesus, is meant to turn the world upside down. Mm-hmm. It's a complete flip. So another way to think about blessed maybe is God is on your side. God is on our side when we're poor in the spirit. God is on our side when not only is God with us, God is for us when we have that attitude in our heart. And then becomes the question, the next question becomes like, well, what's it mean to be poor in spirit? What's that attitude in our hearts? And certainly, I know we're going to be unpacking that a little bit, but the word blessed sometimes is also interpreted as happy. Mm-hmm. And so that's what it kind of points to, what it means. So poor in spirit, now that's a big conversation. That's a debate that Christians have been having for a long time. What's that mean? And I talked a little bit about different interpretations of that in my sermon. John Wesley talked about poor in spirit as like, you're convinced of your sinfulness before God, your helplessness before God, your hopelessness before God. That's poor in spirit to John Wesley. I've also heard people talk about it in terms of like teachable, you're humble, you're open to learn. And then I've also, of course, heard people talk about the poor in spirit as the literal poor, those that are materially poor. And I think there's probably truth in all three of those. You know, we're all sinners, as John Wesley would point out. We all fall short, yes. It is important that we maintain a posture of learning. We've never are going to arrive. Let me just save everyone a bunch of time. We never get to that place, especially in the spiritual journey, where we are at a place where we have nothing left to learn. And in fact, I would argue maybe that's the most dangerous place a person could be in when we're talking about spiritual journey, is a person gets to that point where they think they have it figured out. Mm-hmm. They think they have nothing left to learn. And that's a real temptation for us all. The longer we try to journey with God, the longer we try to be a part of the church. What begins to happen if you're not careful is like even when you go to a worship service, you're not there to learn anything new. You're not there to see anything new. You're there to hear what you feel like you already know. And boy, that it's not even a journey anymore at that point, because you're not moving, right? You're set in place. You're still, anyway.
We've been talking about books and authors, and Peter Enns had that book, The Sin of Certainty. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, you don't want to be there.
No.
You don't want to, we do want to be there, but we really don't want to be there.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, doubt is, in a sense, I mean, we in some circles, doubt is interpreted as something that's bad, mm-hmm. wrong to doubt. Don't doubt. Mm-hmm. But in a sense, doubt's a good thing, because it's saying, look, I don't have this all figured out yet. I don't understand everything yet. I have more to learn still. And so in some ways, doubt's like the other side of the coin that we call faith, right? It's part of it. And so, yeah, Peter Enns is a great author too. Yeah, I like him. And then the way I interpreted the poor in spirit in my sermon is you've got to that place where you're ready for a change to take place. Mm-hmm. And certainly Jesus, as he's preaching this message originally, was talking to a group of peasants, which is, by the way, 98% of the population in that time.
Right.
1-2% of the population basically dominated everybody else in Jesus' day. So Jesus is talking to the peasants and he's saying, look, if you're ready for a change, if you're ready for something to become different, I've got good news for you. The kingdom of heaven is at hand. And so just to put it in historical context, that beatitude makes a lot of sense. Jesus is basically telling the peasants, God's getting ready to turn the world upside down. Mm-hmm. And so that's, you know, blessed are you when you're in that place where you're ready for that to take place and happen.
And of course, there has always been that debate between Matthew here and Luke, who doesn't say poor in spirit. Luke just says poor. But to your point, they were all poor. I mean, the people following Jesus were all poor.
Jesus was poor. Yeah. You know, they were poor. Yeah.
Yeah. In the economic sense. Yeah. You used an illustration about a trip to Guatemala to help make your point in this.
Yeah. Almost 10 years ago now, a group of us from the church went to Guatemala on a week-long mission trip at a place called Mission Guatemala. It's actually started by a pastor, former pastor here at Methodist Temple, Tom Heaton. Wonderful, wonderful man, if you know him.
Yeah.
And I know the organization. It's a great organization. So we went to Guatemala, spent a week there. It's a rattling experience. At least it was for me, to go from Evansville, Indiana, United States, the Western world, to really a third world type of situation, a country. We landed in Guatemala City. We drove from the airport. We traveled a couple hours to where Mission Guatemala is located. And it's clear there's a different way of life there. And when I came home from that experience, people began to ask, how was your trip, of course? What did you learn? What was it like? And, you know, the thing that stuck with me as I just sat there for a week and worked with these folks was that they taught me about my own poverty. And they taught me about our poverty here in the United States. The folks in Guatemala, yeah, they had challenges when it came to material resources, and they had challenges when it came to adequate medical care, sure. But they had one another. They knew their names. They were part of a community. Children were able to run around and play in the streets without fear, these kinds of things. You come back home in the United States and, boy, it's on full display. That ain't how we live, right? I mean, we have material resources, yes. We have, you know, wonderful medical care. You know, it's here. We have all these kinds of things, and we have the resources, but we're isolated and we're alone. And so that's our poverty. And which is, who's actually the wealthy one in this scenario, right?
Right.
Yeah.
It's how you measure it, how you define it, and then how you measure it. So yeah, you already said this, but you offered another definition of being poor in the spirit, and it's reaching that realization that something needs to change. And you said that you asked the congregation just to imagine the world as if God were king and act accordingly. And that gets to the sense of it some.
Yeah, and honestly, over the years when I've talked about that a bunch over the years. It's such a helpful way to talk about the kingdom of God. Imagine the world as if God were king. Now, for me, a lot of times, I have interpreted that in a materialistic way. I mean, and that's just my own bias, right? Living in the Western world. What would the world be like if God were king? Well, the poor would have enough to eat, sure. There'd be adequate medical care for everyone, yes. Violence would be no more, absolutely. All these kinds of things. But there's another dynamic there that we don't talk about. We would be known. We would know the names of people. They would know us. Because here it is, the kingdom of God is where love is always practiced. That's what the kingdom is. And there's a material aspect to that, but also there's a relational component to that. And in our world today, in the United States, and in our churches, we are isolated and alone. Our poverty of spirit is loneliness. And that has devastating consequences in terms of our mental health, relational health, and spiritual health. I would even go as far to say, we're not going to experience the love of God unless it's in relationship with one another as well. And so we can talk a good game, have all the certainty in the world, have all the right answers. We're not experiencing the kingdom of God, and we're not experiencing the love of God unless we're in relationship with one another.
You cited a study. This is an old study, Harvard Study of Human Development, where they took all of these graduates of Harvard, including the would-be president, John F. Kennedy, and then they took another group of people, which included some of the poorest of the poor in Boston, and they were asking the question, what is it that makes a person thrive?
Mm-hmm. It's a fascinating study. It's the longest running study on human happiness that we've ever conducted. And what makes it unique is starting in 1938, they began following a group of men throughout their entire lifetime. And so, as you just mentioned, a significant portion of the group was Harvard graduates. These are very privileged people. JFK was a part of that group. The other group of folks were 450 guys from the Boston area, which, as you mentioned, included the poorest of the poor. The Boston Strangler actually was in the other group. Yeah. So they were in the other group. And they studied everything they could about these people, their community, how they were parented, their grandparents, religion, everything you can think about. And the big question they were asking underneath it all is, what leads to human flourishing? What leads to human happiness? And their big takeaway was this. The number one component, the number one characteristic is the quality and the quantity of a person's relationships. Again, who's really poor here?
Right.
In a United States, in a Western world where we have our fenced-in backyards and we don't know the names of our neighbors, according to the Harvard study, that's a big problem we have is we don't always have the quantity and we don't always have quality in terms of our relationships. And another interesting thing I learned about that study was that they found that if a person makes it to the age 50, the number one indicator they'll make it to the age 80 is the quality and the quantity of their relationships. And there's nothing magical here about it, but one of the things that happens if you have strong relationships in your life is how you deal with stress. So if you have someone, you could go talk to them and bounce it off of them, you know, talk to them about what's going on in your life. That brings down your stress.
Right.
If you don't have that, then you carry that burden alone.
Internalize that.
Yeah. And then stress is, we know that from just research, how horrible that is for our bodies. And so another thing that happens if you have some close personal relationships in your life, like you live with someone, you know, you have a partner or spouse, they remind you to take your medicine and these kinds of things. You know, Randy, I mean, you kind of know that right now with Lisa.
You may have to get one of those little pill boxes. I don't have that yet, but I can see where those are handy.
Yeah, they help you do the right things.
Right.
Have you been to the doctor? Have you taken care of yourself? Or,
right.
You know, all these kinds of things are in that.
And especially for guys.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We're awful about this. Yeah.
I thought about this while you were talking. You know, we have in many ways lamented the changes we see in the next generation. You know, we've labeled now all these generations, and we have been critical of younger generations because they're not like us, I think. Mm-hmm. And they don't have those values that we had. But I think they might be onto something. And again, every time we speak about these generations, we're talking in generalities. But I think in general, they might be onto something, where I think that they do prioritize their relationships over maybe the way we prioritized accomplishment, you know, and climbing the ladder. Because I've noticed in my own workplace, because I often say I get older every year, but the people I work with, they're always about 24 years old, you know? And so I've seen that over a couple of generations now, and they are very close-knit.
Really?
They're very close-knit. Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah. That's encouraging too.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah. And they're talking, not them, but we're hearing now about maybe a move toward a 4-day, you know, work week. And I'm like, wait a minute, I'm getting ready to retire in a little while. You know, I worked 5 days a week and more.
Yeah. What about the 7-day week generation?
Yeah. And those, yes.
Because a lot of the,
right.
Yeah.
So it is interesting. There's some good signs in there. If younger people, of course, they looked at what it did to us. Of course, I'm in one generation. You're in one below that one. But even in each of our generations, I mean, they saw what we did and what we do. They didn't like everything about it.
Right. I mean, every gift casts a shadow.
Yeah.
The success of some of the older generations, material success, it casts a shadow. And just as if you overemphasize relationships, I'm going to say it's going to cast a shadow as well. Yep. The key to wisdom is to figure out where the balance is at between the two. Everyone needs to serve and work. And in a sense, we need something to sacrifice our lives toward. Absolutely. But then we need relationships too to do that. And so there's this balance that has to happen.
I'm not selling Peter Inns books today, but he's got a great book on wisdom as well.
Does he?
Yes, he does.
Yeah.
Okay, so then, Pastor Andy, what is it that makes up a good relationship?
Well, I think I will say it's unique to every person. But as I thought about it, there are some characteristics that emerged for me. First, authenticity, number one, comes to my mind. And what's that mean? Well, I feel like I can be authentic with a person when I feel like I can share what's on my heart, who I am, what I'm struggling with, without fear of being rejected. Instead, I know I'm going to be respected as I share my deepest self. I heard a great definition of vulnerability the other day. What's vulnerability? I can share what's on my heart, right? That's vulnerability. I can share it. And that's authenticity too. You know, I can be authentic. And at our congregation, Methodist Temple, one of the things that we did that was a little bit unique was, rather than come up with a to-do list of things that we hope to do as a congregation, we developed a value statement about who we wanted to be as a people. And we've said as a congregation, we want to strive to be a safe and non-judgmental community. In other words, We want to be a place where we intentionally cultivate the capacity to hear where people are coming from. And we want to be a safe place where people can share who they are. And that doesn't always happen, especially in religious circles. It doesn't always happen. A lot of times we have an agenda and we have a certain set of criteria that a person needs to check off. And so we're trying to go against that. But authenticity is the first one. And then the second one, though, is curiosity. And, what's a healthy relationship? Well, I know I'm in a healthy relationship when someone's actually curious about what's going on in my life, and I'm curious what's going on in their life. There's just, I'm interested in this person. You know, I'm going to ask questions about how was their day, what's going on, how are you doing, these kinds of things. And curiosity really is it's a spiritual gift, I think. You know, it's something that we need to cultivate. I heard a great story about a Zen priest who, the Zen master told this priest as he was in training that every time he sat down to meditate, his job was to figure out what was new about that moment. What is it that you're seeing today that you have never noticed before? And I find that to be a very helpful way of thinking about what is curiosity. You know, when I sit down with a person, I might have known this person forever. I might have been with this person multiple times. But what is it about this person today that's different, that's new? And, of course, to find those things out, you have to learn to be able to ask good questions and not just make statements. You have to be able to ask, hey, what's going on? How's it doing? Are you doing? And then you're looking, you're noticing, right? Like, what's different about them? That kind of thing. As I was working on curiosity in my sermon that morning, I went to lunch with my daughter, Ella, over at Hebron Elementary School. And she's a first grader. So we're talking 6 and 7 year olds. And I was in the curious mode. So I walked in and got in the lunch line with Ella and the little girl in front of Ella. We got to talking and she asked me what I did for a living because I was kind of dressed like a pastor. And then I noticed that she had these sunglasses on. And I said, I was in the curious mode. I said, tell me about your sunglasses. And she pulled them, you know, she unfolded them and she says, these are my favorite sunglasses. These are My Little Pony sunglasses. And she showed me the little My Little Ponies on the glasses. And I was thinking, boy, that was such a life-giving. I know that sounds so basic and simple. It's a life-giving moment because the joy that it brought out of that person as I was just simply curious about what's going on in them. So that would be a healthy relationship. And we all need someone in our lives that care enough about us to ask us how we're doing, what's going on, and then listen as we share ourselves with them. So the second one would be curiosity. And the last one I talked about was, it seems like a lot of times, especially when it comes to friendships, there's a common interest. It could be just about anything, really. But a friend could be someone I like to go fishing with, or we like the same baseball team. Or
you brought up fishing a lot. You must like fishing.
I do like fishing, yes. I grew up fishing. I mean, I live in Ligonier, Indiana, where we played basketball, where we went fishing. You know, that was kind of our option. But, it could be care for creation. This last week, I did a presentation over at Westleman Woods, largest old-growth forest in an urban setting in the United States, by the way, in Evansville, Indiana. And so they asked me to do a presentation on Methodism and ecology. And so it was interesting there because there was a group of about 35 people there who were there, and they were friends because they were very diverse, but they cared about creation.
Right.
And so there's a common interest. And so it could be faith too, right? C.S. Lewis has a great quote where he said, friends are people who care about the same questions. And one of the big questions, of course, is faith. And like our friendship, Randy, has developed because we care about faith.
Sure.
In a very specific way. We're Methodist pastors who care about a very specific understanding of faith. And so we love to nuance it and talk about the details. And that's how friendship is cultivated. And all these things are a part of it, though, like authenticity, curiosity, a common interest, and then you cultivate it. And as you develop those friendships over a period of time, that leads to back to the word blessedness, right? That leads to happiness. And I would even go as far to say really lasting transformation happens because these things are there. I mean, there's some big problems in our world today, but we all know they're not going to get fixed until we take the time to develop the relationships and cultivate the bonds to do something about it. And so, yeah, I, in many ways, was just preaching to myself. as I was going through this, as I go back to my Guatemalan story of my own poverty, we get so busy. Our schedules get so full. And then someone could be sitting here thinking like, well, I know a lot of people. Yeah, but are you known? Right. You know, you might know a lot of people. They might not. They might know your name. But who's the people in your life? Who are the folks in your life who you're you'd be vulnerable with? You actually share that curiosity with these kinds of things. I think that's kind of what I'm getting at.
Yeah, I think so too. And we keep coming back to vulnerability, and vulnerability isn't something that can be forced, but is something that will inevitably happen if we let it happen. Mm-hmm. Like, we don't want to be vulnerable. I don't think we naturally want to be vulnerable and to be open and to expose everything that we're hurt by. But that's when things can really begin to happen in a relationship, because you realize, wow, this person is like me, even though I'm not sharing, the part of my life that brings me pain. This person is. Mm-hmm. Now I'm interested, and now I'm caring. Now I'm free mm-hmm. to open up and to be vulnerable. And after the sermon on Sunday, we did our once a quarter all Sunday school class gathering, and we had Cancer Pathways Midwest in. Executive director spoke, a 16-year survivor of pancreatic cancer spoke, and I spoke about my own experience as a caregiver, and then I mentioned that my wife Lisa is caring for me now. And so there is vulnerability that I never would have wanted.
Mm-hmm.
That has, you know, opened up my own vulnerability, not only to my wife, but to my congregation. And I think it's a lesson in how churches can grow, because I think in many cases we go to church and we go home from church and we go to church and we go home from church. It's only when we go and stay and develop these relationships and spend time together and be comfortable enough with one another that we will allow ourselves to be vulnerable. Now you're on to something that could just blossom into something beautiful for the kingdom.
Yeah. Deep and meaningful relationships, connections. That's what's happening there. I would say that's spiritual growth.
Yeah.
I think maybe one of the most important things I said in the sermon was, we as Christians, we talk about God is love. I want to experience God's love. Well, how do we experience that actually? Through a love for one another. That's how it's done. That's the practice of Christianity. In fact, I'll geek out for a moment here, Pastor Andy. John Wesley, one of the big things that the Methodists talked about was this idea of assurance of spirit. What's that? Well, Wesley believed that a person could experience an assurance. They could experience the love of God in their hearts, that it would not be an idea, but an experience in their lives. And in Wesley's day, some people pushed back on that. They said, well, that just seems so, I don't know, woo-woo-y. I'll use some of my language. People would push back at Wesley and say, well, that just doesn't fit. That's not right. You know, no. And Wesley, here's what he told them to do. If you don't believe me, here's what I want you to do. He said, then go to one of our small group meetings and watch the love that they're sharing, and then you will know.
Yeah.
And that's the assurance of the Spirit. So often we think that this idea is like some individualized thing that happens because I prayed this prayer the right way or took the sacrament the right way. And I'm not going to dismiss that God can't interact with us in that moment in powerful ways. But I find it fascinating, though, Wesley said, no, you go to the groups. Go to the Methodist groups and you'll find the love there that you're talking about. And you'll know in your spirit that it's real. And so what you're talking about, Randy, when you're being vulnerable and sharing your pain and all those things, it's real. It's tangible. We're fulfilling our purpose as human beings when we're able to share and receive love in those ways.
That was his great contribution.
Yeah, and I've always struggled with that one. Mm-hmm. Just a confession on my end, I'll be vulnerable. I remember reading those sermons. I've known John Wesley's story about it's famous, the Aldersgate experience where Wesley writes in his journal, I felt my heart strangely warmed. All these kinds of things. But yet, I always found myself, well, how do I know if I've experienced that? How do I know if I feel it? I mean, I know the right answers, right? I know the Wesleyan things to say, but how do I know? And I just find it very reassuring that how practical he was in his advice on how to experience it. And then we start to realize, oh, that's what he's talking about, love. Oh, okay. You know, that's what it is. That's so down to earth and real and practical now.
It's interesting that he had that heartwarming experience as he was listening to the preface to the Book of Romans by Martin Luther. And I think while Luther didn't use the same language, but Luther was searching, you know, for the same kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
All those greats, you know, they were so worried about not measuring up and what it took to measure up until, you know, they finally found it.
And he found it where? Where did Wesley experience the heartwarming experience? What was happening? Yeah. He was not reading that by himself.
Right.
Someone else was reading that.
In community.
Yeah. In a community of people.
Yeah.
And that's Christianity. Yeah. Like if you read the early church documents, New Testament documents, it's always, how can the love of God be in you if you see your brother and sister and need not do anything about it? How can that be? You know, these are the kinds of things the New Testament is saying. And then Jesus embodies. First thing he does, way before he ever preaches the Sermon on the Mount, what's he do? He calls disciples. He's like, hey, we're not going on this alone. We're going this together. We're going to do this together. And,
right.
You know? Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so God is love. And so you started to set out the challenge before the congregation to share God's love with one another and to push against this poverty of spirit that we've been talking about.
Mm-hmm. And I tried to end with some practicals. Suggestions like do something outside of your routine where you reach out to somebody else and have them, you know, go out for coffee or go for a walk or something like that.
Go fishing.
Go fishing. That's right. I mean, it's a good time of year to go fishing right now. And then I said, if you're an introvert, and this is all very excruciating for you,
yeah.
You know, I get that. Invest in your people, right? Invest in your people. Like if there's a couple folks in your life, but we all need relationships, whether we're extroverted or introverted. We all need them, absolutely. And then the thing that was reassuring to me is after the sermon on Sunday, I had like two different people say, I went out to lunch with a stranger, you know, someone I just met, and had such a wonderful experience.
There you go.
And that's so cool to hear that story because, well, when that starts happening in the life of the church, when you get people reaching out to other people and sharing life together in those ways and they're expanding their circle, if you will, their circle of caring. Boy, that's growth. That's the kingdom really is happening now. They're practicing it. Remember, the kingdom of God is where love is practiced always. And so there, it's happening. And as a pastor, you can find, well, as a preacher, really, nothing excites me more than someone like actually implemented something right. that I said. And I'm on cloud nine about that, really.
That's great. Well, it's still the Easter season. And a lot of times around Easter, we really celebrate the resurrection, but we still have questions about it. And we try to wonder what really happened there and what went on. But I think you nailed it when you said that Christ is risen in us. When we do the kinds of things we've been talking about, there's resurrection. You want a really good, tangible way to experience the resurrection? There it is.
Do it. That's it. You know, and that's the Wesleyan way. Practice faith until you have it. And once you have it, you practice it. And what's the resurrection? You practice the resurrection until you have it. And once you have it, you practice it. And now someone's going to say, well, how do I do that, right? Well, just think about the resurrection stories. They're always about Jesus chasing down his disciples and restoring relationship. And it was in the restoration of a relationship that the risen Christ was experienced. It's so down to earth. It really is. My favorite story is really when Jesus goes through the walls. It's right. Such a symbol, right? Like we have these walls we build up around us, and what's the risen Christ do? Christ goes through the walls and restores relationship. And that's what we're called to do.
He's the door. He said that. He said, I'm the door.
I'm the door, yeah.
We like I'm the shepherd. I'm the light. He said, I'm the door.
That's
one of the I am statements.
Yeah.
Okay, next week, as we move along in this sermon series about the stained glass windows here at Methodist Temple, you reach verse 4 in chapter 5 of Matthew. blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. So maybe just a little bit of a preview on what you're going to try to unpack this week.
I'm wrestling with it. All these Beatitudes are, they're pithy kind of wisdom statements, kind of turn your world upside down types of statements. But here's something that's on my mind. I wish when I was younger, I knew that all relationships and all people change. I think that would have saved me from a lot of grief. Mm-hmm. That's something I'm pondering right now. Blessed am I when I'm okay with someone changing. Mm-hmm. Blessed am I when I'm willing to give up an old way of life that's no longer working.
You're talking about little deaths.
Yeah.
Right?
Little deaths, yeah. Yeah.
Mourning.
Yeah, you're letting them go. Mm-hmm. And then you'll be comforted. You'll be comforted. There's a book that's on my mind. William Bridges is the author. It's a book I read during seminary. The title of the book is Transitions. The gist of the book was this. We get caught trying to live out an old set of rules and an old way of life, and the world has passed us by. We've not mourned, and that's why we've not transitioned. Mm-hmm. And the older I get, you know, I'm a creature of habit. I eat the same thing for breakfast most days. You know, I know how hard this is, but it's about this. For me, that beatitude, as I think about it, Randy, it's about this cultivating this notion of curiosity and being open and intentionally being open to the new, these kinds of things. Trusting that God's going before me and preparing a place for me to see God, not just after I die, but today. And so all that is spinning in me right now.
And it is preparation for the big death, all these little deaths that we do mourn. And just as there's a process in grieving the physical death of the body, there's a process in grieving these smaller deaths that we experience all the time.
Yeah, yeah. Someone asked, I remember right after COVID, someone said, what have you learned during COVID? And I had three things that, of course, I had something to say. But Christ is the lens, Easter is the pattern, and love is the way. That's, as I sat around in COVID, those are the three things. Like, we live in a spiritual world where there's death and there's new life all the time. And love is the way that you begin to notice that you mourn the deaths and you claim the new life. That's love, really. For me, I'm noticing now. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Very good. I think we've hit our average time, so we should probably wrap it up right here. Thank you for listening. We really do appreciate it. And stay in touch. Reach out with an email or stop us here. And if you have any questions, you'd like for us to go over something that you're struggling with, we'd be happy to do that and maybe make this as interactive as possible. But we really appreciate that, the fact that you've taken the time to listen. And, hope to have you listen in again next week. Have a great week.
This has been the Pastor Podcast with Randy and Andy. You are welcome to join us at Methodist Temple in person or online. Methodist Temple is at 2109 Lincoln Avenue in Evansville, Indiana. Our traditional Sunday morning worship service is at 8:30 with our contemporary service at 11. Log on to our website at methodisttemple.church. We see Christ in you.